You know what you're listening to?
Is that a trick question?
It's the I Still Love This Game podcast with your host, Matthew Damien.
He's an idiot. Don't listen to he's an idiot.
Hello and welcome to episode 51 of the I Still Love This Game podcast. Today we only have one game, which is game 6 between the Celtics and Bucks. So in today's show, we're going to obviously talk about that game. We're going to talk about we're going to do a preview of the Pelicans and Warriors series. And we're also going to answer a few questions, depending on how much time we've got left. So let's get right into it. And Boston took control early and they had a, 31-25 lead early on. But Giannis led them back and erased that deficit and turned it into a double digit lead. It was obvious that Milwaukee wanted to limit Jaylen Brown and they put Giannis on him. Morris was huge for Boston in the second half as they clawed their way back into the contest. Antetokounmpo, there you go, there's my best attempt at pronouncing that last name, was massive down the stretch. And Boston was really, they were powerless to stop him. All they could do was really contest as best they could and pray that he'd miss the basket. We saw how versatile he is offensively as they used him in a variety of situations. We saw him on the block, handling the ball, setting screens, and rolling to the basket, offensive rebounding, and distributing the ball. On the other side, the Celtics couldn't make a three down the stretch, and the Bucks controlled the glass. When you couple that with Maker and Giannis challenging everything at the rim, it's no surprise that Boston barely scored. They didn't even score 90 points, actually. And the end result was an impressive must-win victory for the Bucks, and we get a Game 7. And there are no two better words if you're a basketball fan in the playoffs, then Game 7. So let's have a little bit of a preview. And obviously, the home team has won every game this series. It's not the fact that they've just won every game, but they've also established big leads. To their credit, the home team have come back in every single game and have made it competitive. But that's going to have to change if Milwaukee wants to steal this series. If they go down early, they haven't shown the ability to finish the games and complete the comebacks. So then they're going to have to really put forward a solid focus into ensuring that they don't drop and find themselves in a double-digit deficit, even if it's in the first half. Giannis is by far and away the best player in this series. And Game 7s are the ultimate test. I don't want to throw too many cliches at you, but they really are, and especially in Boston. Now, there's also pressure. It's not just on the road team, but the pressure is also on the home team, too, to perform and deliver. They're expected to win. They are the number two seed, even though Irving's injured. They have the home court advantage. All the pressure is on them. They had a 2-0 series lead as well, so they showed the ability to beat them. And when you couple the fact that they've had a few more opportunities, I feel, playing in Milwaukee than Milwaukee has had in Boston to win a game. So if they lose this, they're probably going to look at it as a series they let slip through their fingers. But it comes down to who you trust the most. And for Milwaukee, you've got a clear cut. It's Giannis who's going to lead them. But for Boston, it's whoever steps up. It's the next man up mentality, which works out sometimes good. But when you've got a pressure game like this, you want to have a clear cut leader like Milwaukee does in Giannis. So for that reason alone, I am leaning towards Milwaukee, even though they're the seventh seed, but it's on a knife edge, and it's going to be a really, really fun game. I don't have a whole lot to really talk about with it because I think it's so competitive. I've talked about this series extensively. It's close. You've got one guy in Giannis. You've got a whole bunch of guys for Boston. Boston plays with a lot of confidence at home, and Milwaukee, it's about time that, as I said, they need to, it's imperative that they get off to a good start. It's very rare that in a playoff game you'll see that it be determined in the first half. But as I said before, we have seen throughout this series, the home team win every single game and they've gotten off to great starts. Milwaukee needs to stop that early on and meet that challenge early on. Of course, they have to go on and finish the job. If they are tired or if they have a 5-point lead at halftime, by no stretch of the imagination is that game over. But if they plan on winning, that's a must do. I as I said though, I am going with Milwaukee. It's going to be a great game. It's been a great series. I called this early on. I said that I think this had potential. It sort of reminded me, at least from a situation standpoint, of the 2009 series between the Celtics and the Bulls. Obviously, we haven't had the overtime thrillers that we got with that series. That might have been the greatest seven-game series of all time in terms of all those overtime games that we got and close finishes. But I think, you know, the fact that it's gone seven, you know, pretty much every game has gone, you know, if you look at the last 5 minutes, both teams have been in virtually every single contest. Actually, I can't think of a game where they haven't been, or the game hasn't been decided in that period of time, the last 5 minutes. So I expect nothing less from this. I think it'll be great. And I think this is the type of, if Giannis is going to be a truly great player, I'm talking MVP level, challenging for supremacy in the Eastern Conference. We've sort of forgotten about him. Remember, he was the talk of the Eastern Conference prior to the season. If we're going to start taking him serious, these are the type of games where he has to deliver in a similar fashion to how he just delivered at home. If he's able to produce a performance like that, then all of a sudden he gets right back in the conversation of a young player in the NBA that you can build a team around. And whilst we're on the topics of previews, let's have a look at the New Orleans and Golden State upcoming series. Now, I have talked about this in previous episodes as well, because both of these teams were up 3 games to none, so I sort of got a bit ahead of myself. So I may be repeating some of my talking points, but these are things that have come into my mind recently that I want to bring up. And we're going to assume that Curry will be back, or at least available, in this series. And how quickly Golden State uses him will show us immediately how much they respect the Pelicans as a threat. If they hold off till Game 3, that means that they feel that they can dominate, really. If they bring him out in Game 1, it shows that they have a genuine respect for him. And there's been a lot of talk about Anthony Davis as a candidate for the best player in the world. And I've been a part of that. I've said it a few times, especially after his performance against the Blazers. But what I will say, on at least on some level, is we do need to acknowledge that he was going up against a pretty weak, at least relatively speaking, when we're talking about playoff teams, front line for the Portland Trail Blazers. The question is, will he be able to dominate the Warriors in a similar fashion? And if he is, the series is over and New Orleans wins. And that is a genuine possibility. Golden State, one of their weaknesses is stopping dominant interior players, whether it's rebounding or post play or whatever. And Davis is not a typical dominant inside player, but his game is complete enough to cause him serious concerns. And couple that with the fact that New Orleans has the perimeter defenders that can make the Warriors work extra hard to get their shots off, and that's pretty much what their offense is. And we could be looking at the perfect storm situation for the Warriors getting beaten. And this is the problem that Portland ran into the first two games at home, is they were just bringing Davis right out to the ball handler, thinking you can just isolate this guy on an island. Anthony Davis is far too good of a defender. He's very comfortable and more than capable of guarding a Curry or a Thompson or whoever in those isolation situations. The question for the Pelicans is, can Mirovic do the same? And it's kind of funny how a series of this magnitude just might come down to that question. The Pelicans also have perimeter players that can make the Warriors extend on defense. If Holiday and Rondo, and playoff Rondo, I should say, can come close to their effectiveness, especially against a potentially rusty Curry, they could be in real trouble. If the Warriors do have to resort to jumping the ball against Holiday or Rondo, that will open up things even more for Mirovic and Davis, which was already an advantage for the New Orleans Pelicans. As I said before, this feels like the perfect storm has arrived to beat the Warriors, and they could easily lose this series. The key for them is Durant, and he does have to elevate his game along with Thompson. If they don't elevate their game, even if they play at their typical standard, that may not be enough. And for the first time in a long time, the Warriors' defense and rebounding will be under a microscope. I'm leaning so hard towards the Pelicans. In fact, I'm going to go with the Pelicans in this. Don't ask me how many games it's going to be. I'll give you that answer later on when we get closer to them starting the series. But when you think about it, I just talked about Durant and Thompson having to elevate their game. Even if they do elevate their game, there's no guarantee they will be able to offset what New Orleans can do. Then you got to throw into you got to take into account, Gentry knows this team pretty well. He was the assistant coach for them, the leading assistant coach You have to get the titles right. Respect the pronouns, guys. But he was the leading assistant coach on this team when the Warriors won in 2015. That wasn't that long ago. He's going to know Draymond Green. He's going to know Steph Curry. He's going to know Klay Thompson. He's going to know Livingston and Iguodala. He may not know Kevin Durant as much, and Durant may be the key in this series. And the scary thing about all that is I didn't even really talk about the rust factor that may be in play when it comes to Curry. Who's to say that Curry will even be close to the dominant player? Because one thing to ease your way back into the regular season, he's coming back into the second round against a fantastic team that's in form. So many question marks when it comes to Golden State. And Durant is good enough to lift his team to a victory. But even if he plays really, really well, I'm not sure if I can buy that for a 7-game series. In my opinion, regardless of who makes it through, if it's Boston or if it's Cleveland versus Toronto or if it's even Oklahoma, this will be the series of the second round to watch. This will be the best basketball out of the second round series. And now it's time to answer some user questions. And we're going to begin with, what's an NBA analyst that you listen to? There's not many. Not anymore. When I was growing up, I used to really like Tawny Kornheiser. He didn't take himself too seriously, and he would come up with pretty good things. Ironically, there was actually him predicting that the New England Patriots would go 17-0 when they brought in Randy Moss. It made me really start to pay attention to him, that he knew what he was talking about. When he saw something, he could identify it quickly. And that was in the preseason when he when he made that call. So there's not a whole lot. Look, there's some players that I like listening to. Jim Jackson's one of them. Kendall Gill's another one, actually, if you ever get a chance to hear what he's got to say on Instagram. And Antonio Daniels is another one that I like listening to. But truth be told, there isn't a whole lot of NBA analysts that I listen to. I read a lot of books, a lot of autobiographies of players. But when it comes to analysts, whether it's even guys like Jalen Rose or Chris Broussard, or I just can't stand them. I feel like they're puppets. There's very few players, analysts out there like Jason Whitlock, and they're so extreme to the other end. There's no real legitimacy in any of these conversations. It's who can be the most obnoxious, and there's no authenticity or honesty. So I don't listen to a whole lot of them. The most that I listen to, because I don't have cable, I've got NBA League Pass, obviously, I just watch it on the computer, but the most I listen to these guys is when I get sent clips and you guys say, hey, why don't you address this? Or what do you think about this? Or whatever that, and it's obviously a YouTube link or whatever. But there's very few instances, you know, where I'll go seeking this stuff out. I'll watch the games, but these topics and these points that I make are inspired by what I watch. It's not from, oh, let's watch Inside the NBA or, I don't know, First Take or whatever some of these shows are called, and then say, oh, well, I disagree with that, so I'm going to make a video about it. That's just what I watch in the games, and I think, okay, that's something interesting to talk about. Next question is, what do I think is the most defining moment of Jordan's career? Now, I'm going to surprise you with this, because it wasn't actually a game. It was just after a game, and it was after the 98 finals, and he had just scored 45 points in Utah. We all know the sequence. You know, he was the only Bull to even touch the ball in the final minute. They're down by three, drives, layup, steals the ball out of Karl Malone's hands, takes it down, you know, runs the clock down, crosses over Russell, gives him a tap on the bum or the butt, if you're American, and then hits, you know, hold the pose and hits the game, the series, the championship, the career, seals all that up in one nice little neat package. And it was just after that, and when they were preparing the stage for the trophy presentation, you could see him crying. And he had held it in the entire game. And I played rugby. I don't like to get too personal on this, but this is why I think this is most defining. I played rugby nowhere near the level that he played, obviously. So I'm not trying to compare myself to Jordan. But I know that feeling of when you've been in that situation, like you just have to win. You just have to win. Whatever it takes, you have to win. And everything around you, the crowd, your teammates to an extent as well, they're not even a part of it, you know, of your focus. Your focus is so internalized that whatever it takes, I will do to win. And then after the game is over, win or lose, that's when the emotions come out. And when I saw that from Jordan, see, the reason that this was so defining to me is there's this ridiculous myth that Jordan was just being Jordan. And what does that even mean? That's one of the dumbest, like when people say, oh, LeBron's just LeBron, or Jordan's just Jordan, or Kobe's just Kobe, or Iverson's just Iverson, or whatever, right? The point that I'm saying is that makes that so stupid is Jordan is human. We have to remind ourselves that Jordan is human, and he was just as susceptible to failure as anyone else. If he wasn't perfect down that last minute, as he was, he didn't do anything wrong that last minute. If he wasn't as perfect as he was in that final minute, they would have lost that game and potentially the entire series. And the fact that he was standing there, he wasn't bawling his eyes out, but you could tell that the emotion started to get the better of him. This is before he got up on stage. It just reinforced the fact that, hey, that was just a remarkable performance. This guy is a remarkable player. And we had to see, we didn't see a failure from him to be reminded of that. But him showing emotion reminded me of it. So that might sound a little bit abstract, but that was the most defining moment of Jordan's career to me. And while we're on the topic of Jordan, what are my thoughts on Jordan's Hall of Fame speech? And I thought this was funny because it was nearly 10 years ago and we're in the middle of the playoffs. My thoughts on it, I liked it. And people thought it was a train wreck or whatever. Why? Why was that a train wreck? Why was it what Jordan was saying any different to somebody getting up and thanking his high school coach or his grandmother or whoever? Jordan was talking about the steps or the players that he essentially annihilated along the way and how they all provided him motivation to overcome the inner doubt that he had. Jordan was then starting to look for stuff, whether it was real or imagined, or really overblown, like Jeff Van Gundy's comments, although I can see why he was annoyed with being called a con man. But he was explaining to the audience, or to the basketball world really, that this was my motivation, this is what kept me going. And it might seem petty, but it worked for him. And I didn't see any difference between that and a player getting up and talking about, you know, overcoming trials and tribulations or poverty or racism or whatever it is. I didn't see any real difference. He was talking about the steps that he had to take to reach the level of a Hall of Fame player. Let's find one that's a little bit more to do with the playoffs. Here we go. Who had the better game 5, LeBron or Westbrook? Does it even matter? Does it even matter? I would go with Westbrook just for this. Look, if I had to pick one, both were amazing. Both were iconic games. I would go with Westbrook, though, because they were down 3-1. They lose that game, they're done. And they were also down 25 points in the third quarter. I would argue that they are playing a much better team in the Utah Jazz. But I would also argue that Westbrook has better teammates, too. So that kind of nullifies that. LeBron did have a good start to the game, as he has pretty much throughout the entire series, with the exception of Game 1. But he was able to also right the ship in the fourth quarter when they needed it. So both were amazing. I mean, you're really twisting my arm for me to say Westbrook. I mean, what difference does it make, though? like, just tell me what difference it makes. Not everything is a bloody competition, but all right. Okay, we've got another one here. Why wasn't Russell Westbrook suspended for Game 5? This is a good question. And I might sound inconsistent with this, but allow me to explain. I don't think he should have been suspended because I hate that rule. I hate the rule that if you get up off the bench when there's an altercation going on, you know, someone could be getting strangled out there, but you're not allowed to get off the bench. If you get off the bench, you're suspended. That's insane. It's insane. This isn't the 70s where players were having, you know, brawls every single night. We haven't seen an all-in brawl in, I don't know, since the Malice in the Palace. Players are pretty well behaved when it comes to fights in the NBA. That rule needs to go. But if we're going to be consistent about it, he probably should have been suspended. Now, the reason they said he wasn't suspended was he was already up at the scorer's bench to come in as a substitution. And then there was a bit of a skirmish, not too much, and Westbrook said he thought he heard a horn, and of course that means you can come in for your substitution. There was no horn, so he probably should have been suspended. But I'm okay with him not being suspended because I think that rule's ridiculous anyway. But if you are Utah, or if you're the fans of Utah, you're probably thinking, hey, hold on a second, we didn't see this kind of rationality when it comes to Draymond Green getting suspended against LeBron in game five of the 2016 finals. We didn't see this rationality where it was the Phoenix Suns when Amari and I think it was Boris Diaw getting suspended in game five once again. What's with these game fives? And of course we didn't see, that was against the Spurs after Horry hip checked Steve Nash. And we also didn't see this rationality when it came to Charlie Ward getting body slammed by PJ Brown and pretty much half the Knicks getting suspended. That was so bad that they had to segregate their suspensions because otherwise the Knicks wouldn't have had enough players to field a team. So game six, Patrick Ewing and a bunch of other players were suspended. And then game seven, it was pretty much Ewing by himself. If ever you want to have a conspiracy theory, that's the one to point to, because they were up 3-1, the Knicks. They lost game five, once again, 3-2, and then they were decimated the rest of the series. So if the NBA is to be consistent, and they have to follow that rule to the letter of the law, then Westbrook probably should have been suspended for game five. But that rule has to go. I'm glad that finally we have seen a little bit of common sense with it. Am I secretly hoping that LeBron fails and doesn't make the finals? No, I am not secretly hoping that LeBron fails and doesn't make the finals. I would love nothing more than LeBron to make the finals and fall flat on his face again. I'm kidding, by the way. I don't want to see that. I want to see good basketball. LeBron, with the exception of last year's finals, the 2015 and 2016 finals, he's played with pretty good intensity and focus, and it was great in 2016, obviously, when he led them from down 3-1, but he was also great in 2015 when, you know, next best player was Mozgov or Dellavedova. He was able to make that competitive. I would have voted him for finals MVP that year. And, what do you guys think that I am? Seriously. Thinking that I secretly hope LeBron fails. What do you think? I stay awake at night, you know, with my eyes open, staring at the ceiling, hoping that LeBron loses? No. Just watch the games. Just enjoy them. Just be honest with it. But unbelievable. Okay, let's find a different question. A good one. All right, here's one. What is it like being a fan of the NBA in Australia? Interesting question. I get this far more than you would think. Time zone's obviously a factor. So I started my business. This is going to sound so nerdish, but this is a big reason why I started a business, so I could choose my own hours, so I could watch games. Because otherwise, you're watching games anywhere from 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Those are work hours. So that was a big reason why I wanted to start my own business, so I could pick and choose my hours. I could have it on in the background and not get yelled at by my boss. You obviously don't have the bar atmosphere. Big games you do. I mean, I remember game 7 of the 2013 finals. I went to the casino and it was pretty packed out to watch that. That was between the Spurs and Miami. But it's not like in the United States or other hotbeds of basketball where you can go somewhere or anywhere and the game will be on and you can watch it. I mean, the games are on. I should take that back. They are on, but there's no one there because it's in the middle of the day. There'll be like one or two people watching and they're usually just people that are addicted to gambling. So they're not even basketball fans. They're just betting on the game because, you know, the horse racing hasn't started. There are other things as well that I should probably point out. I think it's ridiculous that certain fans in Australia are so loyal to certain teams. I get why people are loyal to certain teams in the United States, even if they're from out of town or out of state, because those teams still come and play every so often. But we don't have a team in Sydney or Melbourne or wherever in Australia. So why is somebody loyal to the Denver Nuggets or the Minnesota Timberwolves or the Chicago Bulls? Why? Because, you know, at one point you had a couple of your favorite players on there. Be loyal to the players. Maybe that's why I'm a little bit more of a objective fan, because I don't really have favorite players or favorite teams. I just watch it because I enjoy watching it, and I'm able to sort of look at it without any true bias. But that's something that sort of makes me laugh a little bit too. And the other thing is seeing how bad some of these fans adopt American language and calling things lit or whatever. It's like, shut up. Just shut up. You're embarrassing yourself. It's different. The NBA culture in Australia is very different to that of the United States. But, yeah, it has its challenges. It also is, you know, it has its rewards too. You know, if you're on the East Coast of the United States, it's probably hard to catch some playoff games out on the West Coast because of just the time difference. It's probably really difficult to stay up till, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning to catch the end of the game, especially if it goes to overtime. So you got to factor that in. I guess we all make sacrifices to watch basketball. We've got time for about 2 more. Would I ever work for ESPN? No. And this kind of goes into one of the earlier questions, asking me which analysts I like. I think a lot of these analysts, they're dying to just have regular conversations without being so obnoxious, but they've got a lot of executives behind them saying, oh, we got to get ratings, we got to get clicks, whatever it is, and they're looking for obnoxious hot takes. And that's why I would never work for a company like that. We'll finish up on what do I like about LeBron's game? Good question. And it's not a good question because it's difficult. I don't get that enough. I get people saying that, oh, I'm too negative about him or whatever. What I like about his game is at times, sometimes to a fault, he will let the game come to him. Now, he will also be too passive too, so there's a line that he has to draw there. He says the right things, typically, when he's not in passive-aggressive mode, which has become far too frequent, especially in the regular season. But he typically says the right things. He tries to get his teammates involved. I just wish that he would rein it in a little bit more. In terms of his offensive game, there's not a whole lot to not like about it this year. He's looked the most comfortable I've ever seen him when it comes to scoring the basketball. Still turns the ball over quite a bit. But when the ball's in his hands as much as it is, that's to be expected. And I don't hold that against him. The shooting percentages are great, but he's picking and choosing his spots a little bit too much. Sometimes you have to go down swinging, especially in fourth quarters when it's harder to score because teams pick up their defensive intensity and they rotate a little bit more and they make things a little bit more difficult. You know, it's kind of unacceptable to pick and choose your first couple of quarters and get all your points then off, you know, 60% shooting, but then, you know, only take 2 or 3 shots in the fourth quarter because they're heavily contested. But I like his pass-first mentality at times as well. I remember him copping a lot of crap in the 2007 conference finals. And that was a series where he took over game 5 and scored, what was it, 28 or the last 30 points or whatever it was. It was in Detroit. Game 1, or it might have been game 2 of that series, the Cavs nearly won, and he drove down the lane. And Donyell Marshall was actually a pretty solid 3-point shooter, catch and shoot guy, especially in the corners throughout his career. LeBron drove, he was doubled, and he passed it out to Marshall, and Marshall missed it. And this was to win the game, and he copped a lot of criticism for that. I don't think he should have copped any criticism for that. I think he should be applauded for that. That was the right basketball play. And when you hear a lot of criticism coming from me about his game, it's just adding context because there's far too much blind praise of his game. And adding that context might sound like it's hating, but no, it's just putting it in its right historical place. So I do like his game. I've got him in the top 10 of all time. If I didn't like his game, believe me, he would not be in my top 10 of all time. Or he wouldn't be number 2 in my small forwards of all time. And when I say number 2, a lot of people have LeBron ahead of Larry Bird. And the fact that I bring up Larry Bird and I said I would have him as number 1, they're blown away by it. Their jaw will drop and, you know, they'll think I'm an idiot. Just because I have Larry Bird at number 1, doesn't mean I have that reaction if people choose LeBron over him. You know, it's a genuine conversation. It's not an insult to Larry Bird if LeBron is taken number one at that position. So, as I said, just because I've got him at number two, it's not a big distance between the two of them. And the fact, because you look at what a great career that Larry Bird had, the fact that I say that is really a sign of respect. It's a great respect. And think back to the previous podcast I just did where I was talking about how I was a bit surprised that Indiana didn't run a second guy at him to get the ball out of his hands. Think about that for a minute. There's 3 seconds left on the clock. Think about the respect that I'm saying here for LeBron, that we know he's going to get the ball, we know he's going to take the shot, and there's a great chance he's going to make the shot. If I didn't respect or like his game, why would I be saying, hey, Indiana should have at least thought about the possibility of leaving someone wide open in a tied game to get the ball out of his hands? That's a lot of respect to give somebody. Anyway, we're going to finish it up on that. Episode 52 will keep coming out tomorrow, so we're going to keep the streak alive. We got 3 games tomorrow. I don't know what games they are right now. I don't feel like looking them up, but you can guarantee you I'll be talking about them tomorrow in tomorrow's episode. Thanks for listening, guys, and enjoy the games tomorrow.